particular topic that I was planning to speak about tonight, so I don't know if anyone has any suggestions or requests for a Dhamma talk.
I'm very confused about karma and, you know, existence. That, you know, the belief that if we do good deeds in this life, we can finally get off the world of existence. But how good do those deeds need to be?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who judges the goodness of the deeds?
I don't know what it's like, because, you know, sometimes I'm afraid that it's only really good as that achieve that. Okay, that's a good question. We'll talk on karma and karma. If we look at in the natural world, there's this the nature of things is to follow certain patterns and to follow cycles. It seems to be a contagiousness of things. And so this is one of the earliest of philosophical conceptions we see in humanity, taught by different names in different places. In Sumerian or something, they call it Mart. In Persian, it's Asha. In the Vedic literature, they call it Rita. In the later Indic tradition, they call it Artha or Dhamma. And this is an idea of somehow of the order or the sensibleness of nature. And this order happens in accordance with what we call today natural laws. And we think of these natural laws as being kind of abstract things, formulas. We can express them in mathematics, and we expect that things will follow these laws with a very precise degree of accuracy. But that's more or less a modern version, a sort of refined version of this very ancient principle of cosmic order. Now, if you look at how this order works, for the most part it works in a way which is unconscious or unreflective. When something falls out of the tree, it just falls. A rock hits something, then it bounces off in the other direction. A fire heats a pot of water, the water gets hot and boils. Rain falls from the sky and the ground gets wet. So these things always happen just in accordance with these patterns. And of course nature can seem to be very chaotic, but when we start to look at it, then all of these patterns start to emerge. And it seems that at a certain point or period in human history, and perhaps also in individual development, there comes a quality of self-consciousness or self-awareness as to this process. And how and when that quality arises is a complex and controversial matter. But there's no doubt that it does arise. And when it arises, one of the things that it becomes aware of, or perhaps one of the critical things it becomes aware of, is the question of choice. And so when a leaf falls from a tree, it doesn't choose anything, it just flutters down and then falls to the ground. But we have a choice in how we do things. And so because we have a choice, that means we can affect the outcomes of things. We can change things. And so once we start to think like that and to relate to the world in that way, it makes a very profound difference in how we conceive ourselves. And in particular, we become a moral agent. So, you know, the old Zen saying, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, it doesn't make a sound. in a moral context, if a tree falls out, falls over in the forest and falls on someone, kills them, it does it deserve punishment for that? Does it make any bad karma? Of course, we don't think of trees as making bad karma, even if they kill people. We don't think of a tsunami as being something that makes bad karma, that does something unethical, even though it kills thousands of people. But a human being who kills and causes harm to anyone, we think of as being unethical, that they've done something wrong. So this idea of right and wrong arises at the same time as this question of choice arises. Because we have agency, then we can choose to do good or we can choose to do bad, and we must be held responsible for those choices. So this is a conception which seems to arise at a certain point in human development. Uncertain whether it's something that we share with animals or not, perhaps not. I think they maybe have some sort of conception of good and bad, but not sort of a reflective conception of themselves as moral agents. So once we are moral agents, then life becomes a lot more complicated. We have to think about things. We have to be careful about what we do, what we choose. Is this right? Is this the right thing to do? And of course, we can see how much of human discourse and dialogue and communication is about people trying to nut out this very question: what's the right thing to do? What should I do now? And of course, these questions are very complex. And one of the greatest problems is that we never know what the outcome of any choice will be. And we never really know what would have happened if we'd done another choice. Once we've chosen a certain road, we've gone down there, we'll never know what lay down the other road. Even if we backtrack, come back to the fork in the road and then try to go down the other road, it's already changed. It's already a different road. We've changed. The traffic conditions may be changed. You can't make that same choice again. So this is the terrible price that we pay for moral agency, moral responsibility. And of course, that's what it means to be human. It means to be an adult or a mature human, is that we consider ourselves responsible agents. This is why the law has lesser or no penalties for children who might do certain things, but when adults do them, they're fully responsible. And of course, it's very tempting to try to live without that degree of responsibility. It's very tempting to try to argue away or argue outside of a full acceptance of a moral responsibility. And I would suggest that underlies that process of coming to accept our moral responsibility, underlies the course of moral development, of moral reasoning. If anyone's familiar with the work of Kohlberg and Carol Gilligan and others. And the basic idea, very simply put, is that they identified a number of stages in development of moral reasoning. And as far as I can see, the most important stages is basically threefold pattern: the pre-conventional, conventional, and post-conventional. And pre-conventional moral reasoning basically says, I'm going to do this because I want to, and stuff you. And so that's the thinking of someone who's dominated by their instincts or their desires, and hasn't learned how to respect the needs and so on of others. And of course, very characteristic of children, that they it takes time for them to learn to act in a way that we would consider moral. And so for someone who's at that kind of level of development, they would only do what's moral or immoral according to what they think is good for themselves. So if they think they're going to be punished, then they wouldn't do what's bad, because I'm going to get a slap. So that's why they won't do it. But But if they thought they could get away with it, they'd do it anyway. And the next stage is the conventional stage, which is where you basically rely on some set formula or set of rules. So that may be the law, or it may be the authority of the Bible, it may be the regulations of what they're called. And these things become a set of rules, and one's whole, there's no, in that way of thinking, there's no question of reflecting about or relating to those rules. It's simply that the rule exists, therefore you have to do it. Yes, this is kind of it's completely automatic response to them. You have no more agency in that kind of situation than a leaf does, or than a beam of light does, and it propagates through space. Beams of light propagate through space. Speed of light, that's what they do. And someone follows those rules because they're a rule. And of course, this was one of the great things that was tested in the trials at Nuremberg, where everyone was saying, well, we were just following orders, we were just following orders. And the response to that was, well, it's not good enough. You can't say, I was just following orders. There has to be a level of questioning that and putting it in a context. It's not good enough to just follow orders. And so the next stage of moral reasoning was the post-conventional stage, which is where one can reflect on, consider, and try to evaluate different options, and one can have one can understand the first two stages. So you can understand the personal needs, desires, and instincts of people involved in the question, and also you can understand the various laws and rules and so on, precepts that might be relevant in that case. But you're not bound by those things. You can reflect about them and make a mature choice on what you think is the right thing to do, which will be nuanced and contextual. This is like the three stages of moral development, and it seems to me fairly obvious that Buddhism operates primarily at that third level, in the post-conventional stage, and that's how the Buddha wanted people to operate. And this is why the precepts are something which you sikkhapadam samadhiyami, you undertake the way of training, rather than being a thou shalt. That's why the Buddha was reluctant to lay down rules and would only do so when it was necessary. He didn't want people to be trapped into a purely conventional set of morality. When we are really responsible or mature moral agents, we're able to make choices for which will affect our lives. And those choices affect our lives and the lives of others. And those choices are what we call karma. Now, if we go back in time and think about what karma meant in the ancient Indian context, it actually originally meant, as far as we can trace, precisely some kind of act that had some kind of effect. So the ritual was a karma. Okay, so you do a ritual which would bring about some kind of cosmic effect. So for example, maybe bringing the rain, or maybe keeping the devas happy so that the crops would be fertile, or something like that. So you have some kind of end in mind, and for that reason you do a ritual, and that ritual would be called a karma. And we still have a remnant of that meaning is in the Vinaya terminology, when we call the Sangha karma, an act of the Sangha. And so some of the rituals we do, even though they're not rituals in the same sense, but the terminology is descended from that Vedic usage. So it's something which accomplishes some end, as do the Sangha karma we do in the Sangha, where, for example, you do an ordination procedure, and the Sangha does a formal act, and as a result of that act, something changes, so the new ordinands are accepted in the Sangha. But karma, as well as having that ritual meaning, karma also means work, has an everyday meaning. So just what you do when you go out to the fields and plough the fields, sow the crops. Or if you're a carpenter or an accountant or doctor or whatever kind of job that you do, this is your karma. And so again, all of these things, these kinds of livelihood, are kinds of intentional acts which bring about some kind of result. It's not just a meaningless or unfocused act, which is called karma. So then when we bring that into an ethical sphere, and consider how it actually operates within a Buddhist context, you can have this idea of karma being a force which is responsible for, or which drives rebirth. Now this is an idea which was, it seems, current in the Buddhist culture before the Buddhist time, although it's not the case, as is often claimed, that the teaching of karma and rebirth was universal and accepted by everyone, and that the Buddha just adopted it because everybody else in India at the time believed in it. That's definitely not the case. And anybody who says that has simply not reviewed the literature. The Indian religious scene at the time of the Buddha was complex and diverse, and there were all kinds of people teaching all kinds of different things. Some of them taught karma, some of them denied karma and rebirth. And it's actually somewhat surprising to find that in the pre-Buddhist literature, insofar as we can identify it, that the teaching on karma and rebirth is not really a large part of that teaching. There are things that are referred to, processes of rebirth and so on, that we find in the Vedas and the Upanishads and so on. But it's interesting that one of the only times in the Upanishads where karma is spoken of, in the early Upanishads, the pre-Buddhist Upanishads, that when it's spoken of, they take someone by the hand and leads them to one side and teaches them like a secret doctrine. It's the doctrine of karma. So it seems that even at that time, which was not that long before the Buddha, that the teaching of karma was kind of like an esoteric teaching. It certainly wasn't the mainstream that everybody believed in. And of course, as it happened in Indian history, that the three main religions that survived, the Hindu, Buddhism and Jainism, all were karmic religions, all taught karma. And so in subsequent years it became very widely accepted throughout India. But that wasn't the case in the Buddhist time. So what's the meaning of this, and what's the relationship between these concepts? Well, if you look at the kind of work which was very commonly done in ancient India at the time, of course India was an agrarian culture, and the most common kind of karma which people would do was of farming, and sowing the seed and seeing the crop arising. And this was a very powerful kind of programming, and this idea that you the act that you do is an act of giving. You take seed, which is actually perfectly good food, and you throw that seed onto the ground, just tossing it away. And you do that because you understand in your mind that in the future that will grow again because of the seasons and the cycles of time, and will result in even more food. So you can sacrifice a small amount of food now and get much more food in the future. So notice that the ideas that are happening here, you have an idea of time, you have an idea of sacrifice, of giving things up, and you have an idea of working with the cycles of nature. But also there's an idea in there that what comes around, what fruits, is similar to the thing that you throw away now. So if you throw rice, you'll get a rice crop. If you throw wheat, you get a wheat crop. If you plant mango seeds, you'll get a mango tree. And so these are some of the background ideas which perhaps suggested the notion of karma, or at the very least helped to form the way that it was phrased and taught in that ancient Indian culture. So one of the things that we notice from observing nature is that things don't really disappear. And of course this is very much a part of modern physics as well, that energy and matter is neither created nor destroyed. It can be transformed from one state to another. There may be possible dubious sort of controversies and exceptions on that on a certain level, certain interpretations of quantum mechanics and so on, but certainly as a general physical principle that's very true. And this, of course, we can see in nature all the time, that things are constantly changing and transforming from one state to another, that they don't disappear forever. And so there's this question of what happens to us, what happens to our mind, what happens to our consciousness when we die. Our body rots and goes back to the soil, or is burnt. The physical part transforms, and as it's said in the ancient Indian idiom, the earth returns to the earth element, the air returns to the air element, the water returns to the water element, and the fire returns to the fire element. It's a very similar to the ashes to ashes, dust to dust that you find in the funeral eulogy in the West. And so all of those kinds of things happen, but where does the consciousness go? Where does this I go? If that is an energy which is a reality in the world, then surely that can not disappear. Surely what we must be talking about is some kind of transformation, rather than how can that information, those intentions, that power, the energy that we have in our mind, how can that actually just disappear? And so this is a question which still grappled with in modern studies and theories of consciousness. And there's a number of different models, but one common one is the idea of consciousness as an emergent property, and that's the idea that basically that we evolve as physical organisms, and at a certain level of complexity of organizing our brain, then consciousness emerges, and so when the body disappears, consciousness disappears with it. And of course one of the problems with that is that on that kind of theory, that it's difficult to imagine any effect that consciousness would have on any kind of lower part of things. And consciousness just seems to be sort of existing in its kind of rarefied realm at the top of existence somehow, and being concerned only with itself and not integrated with the rest of existence, kind of a residue of the whole dualistic problem of Descartes. And a more Buddhist approach is to see consciousness as being always interdependent with the physical world. It's never actually separated. So from the beginning of evolution to the end of it, consciousness is somehow involved and somehow interdependent with what's happening. So when the physical body decays and so on, there's not certainly, the consciousness doesn't disappear, but it transforms again from one state to another. And this is conceived in Buddhism as being a process of rebirth. Now, I won't go into the controversial questions of actually how the rebirth takes place. The Buddha didn't talk about that very much, but he did say that when you die, that the rebirth happens, the consciousness happens. Now, when that consciousness takes rebirth, of course there is an element of continuity there and an element of change. Of course, you in a sense become a new person. You're in a new environment. You have a new context. Your mind is changing, and yet there are some things that have a continuity. For example, you tend to have similar personality traits. You may have developed certain abilities in a past life. You might have learnt music or mathematics, and then that quality will still carry on for you. Or you might have a certain kind of character, and that will tend to have a certain continuity. You may have memories of the past life, and those memories may affect you in one way or another in this life. And of course there's the question of karma. Now, according to how the Buddha talked about the karma and rebirth, is that the karma is essentially the energy that drives the process of rebirth. and that particular kinds of karma will direct the consciousness in different kinds of ways. So it's important to understand this distinction, that the consciousness in a way is the, you can think of as the vehicle, or the substratum, or the sort of the river or the stream of rebirth itself, but the consciousness or the karma is what directs that, what sends it in one direction rather than another, what energizes it. Now that karma is essentially the either good or bad deeds that we've done during our life. And the most important kind of karma that the Buddha emphasized again and again and again is the karma that we do every day, the regular kind of karma, the unspectacular things we do, the keeping of precepts, practice of generosity, living a kind life, and sharing and giving things to others, and anything that we can do to elevate our mind through study of Dhamma, discussion of Dhamma, practice of meditation, and all of these things. These are all kinds of good karma which help us and help to lead the mind to a good destiny. And similarly, of course, if we break precepts and do bad things, then we tend to lead our mind to a bad destiny. And in a sense that we can see how, to a certain degree, we can see how this happens in this lifetime. And of course, it's very often the case that the people who are good, who help people, who are kind and so on, will end up being happier and having a better life. Whereas people who are very cruel, who lie all the time, deceive others and so on, they tend to not have such a good life. They won't make such good friends, and family will not be with them, and so on and so forth. Of course, that's not an absolute thing, and you always find counterexamples. But generally speaking, I think we can see that, and as the Buddha pointed out, that there are many benefits to living an ethical life that can be observed here and now. You don't have to wait. It's not dependent on a belief in karma. It's a very important point. The Buddha never said that doing good or keeping an ethical life was dependent on you believing in karma. On the contrary, he said that we should just observe how it affects our own mind, how it affects our own lives, and that's enough to be able to live a good life by itself. So this is the main thing that will direct the mind. Now it's important to understand that karma doesn't just mean anything that you think or anything which you may sort of random stuff that goes through the mind. Karma has to be a focused and directed ethical choice. Right? So again, to remember that the basic examples of karma that I mentioned in the beginning, say doing a ritual or doing work, these are the things that they're a focused and directed activity that actually leads to a certain kind of effect. And that's what karma is. So it's not the case that every random thought that goes through your mind is a karma. Actually, that stuff is basically like white noise. It cancels itself out. It's just the kind of the fuzz of existence. What's the karma is the actual intentional action to do either good or to do bad. This is your karma. Very often in Buddhist circles, they make a big fuss about what they call the last mind moment. And they'll tell you that your rebirth is dependent on what you do with your last thought or something like that. And this is not the case, and this is a product of the Abhidhamma theory and not what the Buddha himself taught. If we look in what the Buddha taught and what he mentioned, then the karma which will determine your rebirth will usually be of three kinds. One is either a very strong or very heavy karma. So that may be either good or bad. So for example, if you've done something like murder someone, then that obviously a very strong negative karma will tend to usually have its effect at the time of death. Or if you've done very strong good karma, for example, if you've practiced jhana, for example, then that will almost always overrides any other karma and will lead to rebirth in the Brahma realm. And so that very strong karma would be the first one, or else very the regular karma that you do every day will also have its effect. And in some cases, karma which is near the time of death will have its effect. Now, the way that the Buddha taught about this karma which is near the time of death is not the same as the last thought moment. The Buddha didn't say last thought moment. He never used the word last thought moment. It's not, again, it's not just that you happen to have a random thought at the time of death and that this can affect your karma. That's not the case. What is the case, and the examples, the specific examples that's told in the suttas, for example, you have the case of Dhananjani, who is the corrupt tax collector, and he was lying on his deathbed, and Sariputta came and taught him, and he was filled with faith and devotion, and was even able to meditate in his deathbed, and for that was reborn in the Brahma realm. Or another case that's mentioned in the suttas is of a soldier who goes to battle, and he's in the middle of the war, and he's thinking, and his mind is filled with hatred and anger and wanting to kill. And all he has in his mind is the thought to kill as many human beings as he can. And at that time he's killed, and that karma, which he's actually committing at that time, will direct his rebirth. So in these cases you can obviously see that there's a very strong moral act which is done at the time of death, and that is what directs the rebirth. It's not just a random thought moment. So for the vast majority of people, they're not making that kind of ethical choice at the time of death. Most people die in either an accident where they're just in a car accident or something like that, or else they die in a hospital bed and so on, and they're not actually making much ethical choice. So for those cases, the period of time before your death is not going to determine your rebirth. So in life, obviously, we make many good choices, we make many bad choices, and in some kind of sense, that works itself out. There's no judge of those things. There is a very beautiful sutta which talks about that, and this is in the Anguttara Nikaya, and it talks about somebody who dies and goes to see Yama, the god of the dead. And of course, this is something which is not really a part of kind of the Buddhist theory of rebirth in any kind of serious sense. It's just one kind of little fable or parable which is found in one sutta. But anyway, the fellow dies, goes to Yama, and Yama says, "Did you see the first messenger that I sent for you?" And the fellow says, What messenger? I didn't see any messenger." He says, "Didn't you ever see a sick person, somebody lying in their bed, and unable to move and weak and suffering?" He said, "Yes, I've seen sick people." "Well, didn't you understand that you too are of the nature of that sickness, and that you too should be diligent and should be heedful, because you may well fall sick at any time?" He says, "No, I didn't heed that messenger. I was heedless." And he says, "What about the second messenger? We sent you an old person." He said, "No, I didn't heed that." He said, "What about the dead person?" He said, "No, I didn't heed that either." And then at the end of it, Yama falls silent. And the man says, "I didn't heed any of those. I lived a bad life. I was negligent." And Yama falls silent. So Yama's role is not to be a judge. Yama's role is to be a mirror, is to call for people to reflect on their life and to see for themselves, did they do good or did they do bad? And this seems to be, if you look at the accounts of near-death experiences, it seems to be very much in line with how people actually experience the time of death, and that there seems to be a kind of a presentation or confrontation with one's own karma, that one's own choices made through life, and an understanding of whether one's lived well or badly. And also a realization, in some cases, like a realization that you know, one's life had a certain purpose, that one was there to work on or to overcome certain things, and whether one's fulfilled that or not. That's actually something which is comes across quite strongly in some of the stories of near-death experiences from people who've committed suicide, that they immediately, as soon as they pass pass over, that there's this, comes this very, very strong realization that they blew it, that they came here to surmount something and to overcome some kind of problem, and that they just tried to opt out and gave up. So this karma leads to good rebirth or bad rebirth, depending on how it goes. According to Buddhism, of course, there are many different realms of rebirth. The human realm is one of the good realms of rebirth. Important to remember that the human rebirth is always the result of good karma. And so even though one may have a lot of bad karma, of course we've all got mixed good karma and bad karma in our lives, but the fact that we're born as humans is always a good karma, because it means we've got intelligence, we've got consciousness, we can reflect on our lives, and we can do better, we can change. So this is always considered to be very auspicious. It's not the case, of course, that everything that happens to us in our life is because of karma. Things happen to us in our life because of many different reasons, and karma is only one of those that affects some of the things in our lives, but not everything. So karma primarily is the thing that directs us to one rebirth or another, but not necessarily governing everything that happens to us in our life. And again, according to Buddhism, that there are many different realms of existence: heaven realms and ghost realms and hell realms and animal realms and so on, and that we've all been born in all of those places many times in the past, and we will again many times in the future unless we get enlightened. So it's when we're looking at how these different realms of existence are described and depicted in the Buddhist scriptures, then of course it's fairly obvious that they are heavily influenced by the Indian cosmology at the time. And it's not at all certain how literally that we are meant to take these things. You know, for example, like the existence of, say, the 33, heaven of the 33 gods, Rusaka as the king of the gods, and all of these kinds of things. Is that a metaphorical description? Or is that literally a being called Saka and so on? So I think these are questions which are perhaps subject to debate, but there's no doubt that there are held to be many different planes of rebirth, and of course that's entirely consistent with our own understanding of our mind, because we can see that we have many different kinds of karma, many different kinds of acts, both good and bad, and so this can produce many different kinds of worlds, just as the acts that we do in our world here and now produces great diversity because of the different choices that people make. And even on this planet Earth, we have heavens and we have hells, and so this is really just an extension of that to a cosmological matter. So the human realm is always the special one, it's the pivot, because it's in the human realm that the power of choice is the most effective, kind of mixture of happiness and sadness, and the fact that we're placed in moral dilemmas in our lives gives us the power to choose and the power to affect the course of our lives. You know, we can't do so much good. If you're born in the heaven realm, you can't do so much good. You can't feed the poor, there aren't any poor. You can't look after the sick, there aren't any sick. So this is why the human realm is always felt to be the best of us. So of course, perhaps the most important part of, or the number of important things the Buddha taught about karma, and one is the four kinds of karma, and that is that there's black karma, with black result. Okay, so you make a choice to do something wrong. Harmful. There's the good karma with good result. White karma with white result is called the good karma. And then there's mixed black and white karma with mixed black and white result. And so that's very reassuring, isn't it? That very often in our lives we try to make a choice. We don't know what's right. And however much we think about it, we realize that, well, it's got good sides to it and bad sides. And we really try to work out, is this right or is it wrong? We want it to be one of either or the other. So this is a very, in Western thinking, it's a very Aristotelian kind of logic. It's either or. It's the law of the excluded middle. And Buddhism and Indian logic loves to include the middle. Okay? and doesn't exclude the middle at all. So you have both black and white karma. And that's how many things are. That's when you're making a lot of choices that actually has good and bad effects. And is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Well, it has both. Yeah, you say just say the recent bhikkhuni ordination. There's a choice to do that. Well, it's obviously had good effects and it's had bad effects. Can you say it's entirely good or entirely bad? Well, no, you can't. You can make a judgment and say that it's mostly good or mostly bad. But the fact is that there's been a lot of good that's come out of it. There's also been some harm that's come. And so from a Buddhist point of view, that's not in itself particularly problematic. It just means that life is complex and that we can't always make easy judgments on these things. But then there's the final kind of karma is neither black nor white karma that leads to the ending of karma. So this neither black nor white karma, of course, is the karma of following the Eightfold Path. Now when we practice Dhamma, and we practice it almost like the conventional level of the teachings of doing good and keeping precepts and practicing harmlessness, and it's often said with some justification that that's mainly what's practiced in popular forms of Buddhism, then in a sense that's quite limited. It's operating within a limited sphere, and the results that you get will always be limited. So you may go to heaven realm for a long time or to hell realm for a long time or whatever, but it's never infinite. It always has some kind of limited response. Whereas the karma which leads to an ending of karma is not limited in that way. And so this is because it's done in that context of liberation, the context of nirvana. When we practice the Eightfold Path, of course the Eightfold Path itself is pure and is entirely good karma. There's nothing bad mixed in with the Eightfold Path. So there's no contradiction between practicing good karma and practicing the karma that leads to the ending of karma. In many ways, we might do exactly the same thing. So if you're practicing entirely just to make good karma, then you will be kind and keep precepts and all of those things. And if you're practicing the Eightfold Path, you'd do exactly the same thing. But somebody who's practicing the Eightfold Path will also do some extra things as well and have some extra emphasis and orientation. And the two main things that would distinguish that would be, first of all, the right view and the understanding and to make efforts in terms of understanding the Buddha's teachings, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, Dependent Origination, to know and understand what the Buddha was talking about. And the second thing that one would do is to apply that in meditation. So meditation itself is not necessarily a transcendental practice, and many people do it simply in order to find some peace of mind, some happiness and so on, and that's fair enough to use it in that way. But if it's practiced within the context of the Eightfold Path as a whole, then meditation should be something that leads beyond karma and leads to the ending of karma, leads to cessation. So for somebody who's practicing in that way, it's not in order to lead to a better rebirth, but in order to lead to the ending of rebirth. And the ending of rebirth might be something that happens in this life. If one attains to arahantship, then there's no rebirth after this life. It may be something that's one attains to one of the lower stages of enlightenment, so we get a few rebirths left, but not so many. Or it may be that if you don't attain to any of the stages of enlightenment, but you're still programming and setting the mind in that direction and developing the practice in a way that will be more of the foundation for practicing in future lives, so that you can have these different levels of result. But in any case, you're essentially undercutting the fact of rebirth as such. And the reason why this happens, the essential difference, is the notion of self. And if you come right back to the start of my talk this evening and think about that, how the notion of karma arises with the notion of agency and the notion of identity, that I am someone who can choose to do this or do that, and that by doing that it has an effect. And so there's this notion of I, this notion of self as the actor. And this is very fundamental to the Indic notion of the self. And the self is it's always said to be the wielder of power, the vasavati, someone who can actually act in an effective way in the world. This is the self. So when we take from the Buddhist perspective of not self, we're in a way severing that link, and so the notion of identity or self-identity connects us with our karma, and that identifies us with our karma, that's lost. And so the karma dries up or dissipates. So in a sense that even though we have this idea like karma sakon here, that we've cited in the chant before, it means I'm the owner of my karma. So to own something is an active state. You don't just own something passively, but you own something because you claim it. So you have to actually actively go out and claim that karma. And so this is what the noble ones do, is they stop claiming their karma, they stop owning it, they stop reaching out and grabbing their karma and saying, this is me, this is I, this is what I am. And so that allows that energy to disperse. And so this, in a sense, is very mysterious. It's like stepping out of the round. I mentioned before that you have this kind of law of cause and effect, or the law of that energy is neither created nor destroyed, which holds in the physical realm, you know, pretty much for most of the physical realm. It may be violated in certain very extreme circumstances, perhaps in black holes or Big Bang or something like that. But in Buddhism, that idea of karma and effect is also generally holds true for the world, but in a sense is violated or is transcended in the case of someone who attains nirvana. So in that case then the karma doesn't have any effect, or if it fruits in their life before they pass away, then it will fruit in very mild forms. So for example, Venerable Angulimala, who was a serial killer, became a monk and then became enlightened, and he went on alms round, and somebody threw some rocks at him, some stones, and he came back and his bowl was broken and he had cuts. And so the Buddha said, well, that's the fruit of the karma that you did from killing all those people. So it's highly attenuated because of his Dhamma practice, but he's still there. So this is just some reflections on the notion of karma and so on. So hopefully that maybe cleared up a few issues. And I don't know if that's illuminated the confusion or has added to it. But anyway, I offer this to you for your reflection. And if anyone has any thoughts or questions, most welcome.